This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome, my friends. Yes, we're going to cover the coming crisis again this week. We'll travel to Brazil to find out about those deadly floods, more signs of climate change. You know, the words former AWARE man Barack Obama was afraid to mention in the State of the Union address. Climate change? Not once. Our interview is with Kiko Brito, Communications Director for Greenpeace Brazil. He grew up in the worst-hit area. You will hear an interview with the man Christopher Hitchin loves to attack, Nafiz Mosaddegh Ahmed. Nafiz has a new book with an important concept, a model for the interactions of the many crises we face. Sure, we have a climate movement, a peak oil movement, foodies, and economic critics, but how do the many forces of decline interact? Find out a little bit in our new interview. Despite all this, I'm starting to develop a weird sense of hope. Noam Chomsky says it's over, we are just, quote, kissing each other goodbye. I don't agree, and I'll tell you why. But first, this. This is Alex Smith, your official nobody. Normally, I try to stay out of American politics, but today, I just can't shut up. Maybe tomorrow, like Keith Olbermann or Julian Assange, I won't be allowed to speak freely anymore. I want to say, all hail to the incoming corporate government. Now it's out in the open. Friendly fascism has arrived in America. It's in the big news. You can read about it, and the public doesn't give a damn. Finally, free enterprise and free government have become one and the same. There is a label for that, though. Before World War II, the inventor of fascism, the Italian dictator Benito Mussolini, described it, quote, "Fascism should more appropriately be called corporatism, because it is a merger of state and corporate power," end quote. He was hung for that. Here are just some of the signs that I can't shut up about. I'll give myself maybe 8 minutes, and that's all. Here we go. Remember the Supreme Court decision that allowed U.S. corporations to spend gazillions on election ads because they're persons, too? Well, tight on the Bush-appointed Supreme Court bench sits one Clarence Thomas. Now the Los Angeles Times reports Clarence's wife received $680,000 from the Heritage Foundation. That's the big business think tank founded by giant corporations, including the Koch brothers. You don't buy a Supreme Court justice. Just hire his wife. For years, Clarence Thomas has filled in forms saying his wife had no income worthy of note. He lied. There will be no investigation, no punishment. Big-time judges can just go back and change those forms. Can you believe that? Disgusting corruption at the highest levels as corporations pay off a Supreme Court justice. And what about the bankers getting one of their own into the deepest office of the presidency? William M. Daley was on the executive committee at J.P. Morgan Chase & Company, one of the biggies, too big to fail, before being appointed as President Obama's chief of staff. And oh yeah, they got a bunch of that TARP money too. Remember all those fraudulent mortgage securities knowingly sold to the public and institutions overseas? J.P. Morgan was part of that. Now we know for sure there will never be an investigation or charges of the big fish. Even more disgusting corruption as bankers openly take over the weak Obama regime. Daley is from the Chicago political mafia that ruled the city for generations before Rahm Emanuel went back to take over the mayor's chair. He is the child of Chicago boss Richard J. Daley, who ruled the city for decades, brother of Illinois legislator John P. Daley, and brother to Chicago's current mayor, Richard M. Daley. Obama's new man, Daley, has been on the board of directors of defense contractor Boeing and drug maker American Company. Even worse, Obama appointed Jeffrey R. Imhelt, chairman of GE, General Electric, since September 2001, as the new job czar. GE, the company that sent thousands of jobs overseas in the last decade, closing plants in America. The conflicts of interest are huge. GE is one of the top biggest American defense contractors, and in the downturn of 2008, GE was rescued by the American taxpayer when the Federal Reserve bought $16 billion worth of shaky commercial paper from GE. According to Jeff Gerth of ProPublica, there were more goodies for GE as it became the largest customer of another corporate support program, this time run by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corp, the FDIC. That's another $74 billion worth of debt issued by GE and guaranteed by the federal government. Help yourselves, boys. Don't be shy. Until this month, GE also owned NBC and MSNBC. They got permission from the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, to sell a 51% stake of those media companies to the cable company Comcast. The FTC chairman, John Leibowitz, was appointed by President Obama. Now, Wayne Madsen, in his weekly World Roundup, says Obama and FTC Chair Leibowitz were college roommates in New York in the early 1980s. They were both studying in New York during that period, but it looks to me at different colleges. I haven't been able to find Wayne's sources for that claim, but it wouldn't surprise me. I wouldn't usually recommend the Wayne Madsen report, maybe, but he really called it in his last show, which he calls the final triumph of fascism in the United States. As soon as Comcast acquired MSNBC, its highest-rated star, Keith Olbermann, suddenly announced his program Countdown and the famous Worst Person in the World routine was over. Just a coincidence, folks. Nothing to see here. Move along. I think Olbermann is just a big chill for the remaining journalist serfs left in the mainstream media. It used to be called putting a head on a pike to warn off the smaller rebels. We can expect an almost spontaneous, undirected wave of rearrangements, contracts not renewed, as the media goes even more on the corporate cheerleading team. In a few years from now, I expect that independent journalists like myself may be found irrelevant and swept away, or the fee-based access system for the internet will exclude volunteers like myself. Prickly truth-tellers could have some child porn secretly injected on their computers before a big bust. I mean, who knew Noam Chomsky was molesting, fill in the blank, all those years? Or maybe rape charges from women who bragged about the sex to their friends and deny it now. You don't even have to lay charges to start an international manhunt with a permanent smear on the name. That's Julian Assange, and that's how fascism works. Okay, here's another sign of the time, this time from the state of Arizona. That grand state of Arizona has a plan to help its people cope with raging budget deficits. The state is moving to cut 280,000 of its poorest citizens off Medicaid. For the sickest, it's an invitation to move to another state. Ah, who needs all those cripples and grandmothers and kids who need special care? We may see migrations of the poor from state to state, as happened to the poorest people of New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. Then we'll get media success stories about the few who prosper, who benefited from having their generations-long community destroyed. Sign again when you see unions blamed for the poor state of the economy instead of the men who ship production out of the country. That's corporate fascism at work. Union busting has gone one step bigger. Bust the old pensioners collecting that money they paid in over 30 years of work. Strip those old people of their pension money. Yeah! It's happening right now all over America. If you are a municipality, a state, or a big company who spent all the pension money on something else, just declare bankruptcy. The federal government is working on legislation to allow states to go bankrupt. Then all those public workers can be kicked out on the street. Hey, thanks for your years of service. As you heard on Radio EcoShock from our guest Bruce Gagnon, there is a method to this madness. Big corporations and the Pentagon need the last tax money to keep developing their plans for total control of space and from space, the planet. They get rid of entitlements, ooh, how evil, which means taking care of the sick, the disabled, and the elderly, to keep money for corporate big boys like Lockheed Martin. I always thought it was sick that the Vice President Cheney's wife, Lynn, was on the board of directors of Lockheed Martin. She stepped down in 2001, but maybe she remembered a few names and phone numbers. Lockheed Martin gets about one of every $14 spent by the Pentagon, and that's gazillions, people. Read the article by William D. Hartung in Tom's Dispatch, republished in Mother Jones, January 12, 2011. Just listen to what Hartung writes. True, Lockheed Martin doesn't actually run the U.S. government, but sometimes it seems as if it might as well. After all, it received $36 billion in government contracts in 2008 alone, more than any company in history. It now does work for more than two dozen government agencies, from the Department of Defense and the Department of Energy to the Department of Agriculture and the Environmental Protection Agency. It's involved in surveillance and information processing for the CIA, the FBI, the Internal Revenue Service, the IRS, the National Security Agency, the NSA, the Pentagon, the Census Bureau, and the Postal Service. Naturally, the company produces cluster bombs, designs nuclear weapons, and makes the F-35 Lightning, an overpriced, behind-scheduled, underperforming combat aircraft that is slated to be bought by customers in more than a dozen countries. And when it comes to weaponry, that's just the start of a long list. In recent times, though, it has moved beyond anything usually associated with a weapons corporation and has been virtually running its own foreign policy, doing everything from hiring interrogators for the U.S. overseas prisons, including at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba and Abu Ghraib in Iraq, to managing a private intelligence network in Pakistan and helping write the Afghan constitution, end quote, from William D. Hartung. Read that, folks. Find the links for all that in my blog at ecoshock.info. And it's not just in America. If you want to know what is happening in your community now, check out the undercover cops that were dragged out from under the stones and exposed in the United Kingdom. At least four British longtime environmental activists have been exposed as police moles. The taxpayer created these long-haired, rabble-rousing climate campaigners and animal rights activists, and wouldn't you know it, they are always the ones suggesting violence, entrapment, pure and simple, another fascist tactic. One agent slept with a woman to get information out of her. Is that part of the police code of conduct? Was she raped by a person in authority without her consent? Get all the dirty news at indymedia.org.uk. You can bet that's happening in North America by the underemployed minds at the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI and all those nameless things they've set up in our names. Corporations rape the land, the sea, and the atmosphere, and we, the taxpayers, investigate those who object. The people trying to save a livable world. That's fascism, too.
I'll be out with good time by 2009. I hope there'll still be some old growth back there. And the fella who looks just like Jim Carrey, he sure ain't a sharing myself. 'Cause he was a spy for the FBI, and they busted Dave Morgan.
An author named Bertram Gross got it all right in his 1980 book, Friendly Fascism. That's still worth a read, published by South End Press. I've got a link to some online excerpts in the ecoshock.info blog. Here is one sample from Bertram Gross. Quote, "As I survey the entire panorama of contending forces, I can readily detect something more important, the outline of a powerful logic of events. This logic points towards tighter integration of every first world establishment in the United States. It points towards more concentrated, unscrupulous, repressive, and militaristic control by a big business, big government partnership. That to preserve the privileges of the ultra-rich, the corporate overseers, and the brass in the military and civilian orders, they squelch the rights and liberties of other people both at home and abroad. That is friendly fascism," end quote, from Bertram Gross. By the time David Corton wrote When Corporations Rule the World in 1995, it was already too late. Now they do run America right out in the open, with bankers and CEOs moving into the White House while billionaires buy the elected representatives. I'd like to close with one more quote. "Through clever and constant application of propaganda, people can be made to see paradise as hell, and also the other way around, to consider the most wretched sort of life as paradise." Adolf Hitler said that. I don't know who sang that song for Earth First about he looked like Jesus, but he was the FBI. And our background music, though, was the appropriately named Club to Death by Rob Dugan. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. At the start of 2011, there have been a series of heavy rainfall events in several parts of Brazil. You may have seen the news footage of incredible water and mudslides pouring through towns. Over 800 people lost their lives. To get the inside picture, we now go to Rio de Janeiro to speak with Kiko Brito of Greenpeace Brazil. Kiko, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi. Hello, Alex.
What a tragedy for the country of Brazil. Can you tell us what happened?
Actually, what happened is that on January 12th, it rained on a region about, you know, it's a mountainous region about 100 kilometers from Rio. It rained about 260 millimeters of rain in the span of just 12 hours. Usually, the average rainfall for the month of January in that area of the country is around 300 millimeters. So close to 80% of the water this year came down in just 12 hours. And it hit an area that is heavily populated. with a lot of people living on areas, as we call them here in Brazil, areas of risk, you know, mountain slopes, you know, mountainous rivers. Most of these are illegal occupations. And, you know, when the water hit, there were no trees, no massive trees to speak of to hold the terrain in place. So the world came tumbling down. Basically, it was slated by the UN last week as being among the 10 worst mudslides in world history.
Were there any natural areas that weren't built up that could be used as a comparison where perhaps damage was less?
Well, actually, I can give you a little bit of history. This is an area that I know quite well. I spent most of my childhood there. You know, it has always rained heavily during the summer in that region. And, you know, mudslides are a fact of life. You know, you didn't have so many people before in the area, and you had much more forest cover, meant that, you know, the trees acted as some sort of natural defense, keeping the mudslides in check. They wouldn't avoid them, but they would preclude them from having such a catastrophic consequence. These heavy rainfalls had been increasing over, you know, a decade or so. And the last big rainfall in that area was last year. And then there was another huge concentrated rainfall in 2007 and 2006. So, you know, now you have sort of these extreme weather events happening in areas that are much more heavily populated. And so conjunction of all these factors just have made the consequences of these storms catastrophic.
I understand there was also a flood in Maranhão near the mouth of the Amazon in northern Brazil. We've got 190,000 people forced from their homes there and an important iron mine cut off. What do you know about that?
Well, the effect of life in Brazil, you know, like blizzards in Canada. We are in the tropics. We have two big rainy seasons in Brazil, both in the summer. But, you know, Brazil being a big country, we have summer in the northern part of the country in June, July, and August, pretty much. You know, it's in the northern hemisphere. And in the southern part of the country, summer comes in December, January, and February. So we have had these torrential rains in the Amazon. And on the other hand, we have also had extreme droughts in the Amazon over the past ever since 2005 being the biggest drought so far recorded in Amazon. And then last year we had another one along the basin. The Negro River is a tributary of the Amazon. These rains are clearly in their strength in Brazil. Right now, south of Brazil, in a state called Santa Catarina, which was ravaged by heavy rains in 2008, is already suffering with floods, and, you know, about 50 people have died already there. So, you know, heavy rainfalls in Brazil are a way of life, but the truth of the matter is that they're becoming stronger, and they're falling over areas which are and with less forest cover, meaning that the mess is all over the country pretty much the same. Right, we had heavy rains in the northeast of Brazil, which is an area, it's a semi-arid area of the country. We had heavy, heavy rainfalls in February of last year, killed, you know, more than 100 people. So I guess that Brazilians will have to get at least used to the fact that, you know, the weather and nature are not going to be kind as they have been with them.
President of Brazil, Da Silva, has said, and I quote, "We need to look more seriously into the climate situation these days. Something is changing, and we still have time to fix it." So does Greenpeace think human-made climate change is also a factor in these so-called natural disasters?
It's a little premature to affirm that. What we believe, based on a number of scientific studies that have been put out over the last decade, is that in as much as you can't attribute these things with a 100% certainty to climate change, the pattern does fit the description of what would happen to the climate in Brazil in a warmer world. So there's a good chance that weather patterns are changing, you know, and rains are becoming heavier and more concentrated. Droughts are becoming longer than they used to be. So it's nature sending a sign that we should be more cautious than we have been.
Brazil is part of a group of countries called BASIC, and I understand there's an upcoming meeting of those countries in India. Do you know whether this will change Brazil's position on climate change, or what is Brazil's position on climate change?
Very hard. I don't think so. I don't think so based in past history. You know, these floods have been getting worse, or these extreme weather events have been getting worse. We had a hurricane in 2005 that was a first in Brazilian history. We never had hurricanes. But, you know, once the summer is gone, people get back to their normal lives, so do the politicians. And most of to be done in order to avoid the consequences of these extreme are already written down. You know, it's in the planning board of the government. It's just that, you know, during the flood season, governments will say that they're doing a lot of stuff, and then comes the next flood, you realize that they didn't do anything. As far as the BASIC meeting, Brazil and the BASIC have had sort of a contradictory type of behavior. For example, Brazil in Copenhagen in 2009 made a commitment of reducing emissions. It was a voluntary commitment. And in a way, together with the Chinese, the South Africans, and the Indians, you know, it gave a little bit of hope to the rest of the world that, you know, you're forming a diplomatic group that could push the climate agenda to the rest of the world. Well, in Cancun, the BASIC didn't play any significant role. And in the other BASIC meetings since Copenhagen, and nothing concrete out of them. The Brazilian agenda with the other BASIC is still dominated by economic and development issues. I would not expect much, but Greenpeace will continue so that something good comes out of these meetings.
What is your feeling about the way Brazilian people are feeling about this now? I mean, does it feel like a state of emergency, even though you've had floods before? Is this one something like the big one?
The country was taken by a sense of helplessness once it started to see the images of what was going on in the area that was ravaged by floods in January 12th. And the amount of solidarity that the country displayed so far has been unique in Brazilian history. You know, their donation centers were set up throughout the country. For the first time in many, many years, the Brazilian Blood Bank had to turn people away because it didn't need more blood. That's quite unique for the Brazilian blood, which is run by the government. So there's a sense of national shock, and there's a sense also that something must be done. But, you know, the truth of the matter is that if these years serve as an indication, one, the rainy season is over, perhaps people will just go back to their lives. And they will stop putting pressure for things to change. So, I don't know, let's wait and see. Perhaps this time things will be different. You know, there's a lot of talk in the country, in the media, and even among politicians that Brazil should pass a law to make governors and presidents and mayors responsible for not protecting their population during the floods. Because, you know pretty much what you have to do. You have to remove people who are living in areas of risk. You have to plant more trees. And we have to stop thinking that, you know, we can just put our reavers inside pipes. That's also a problem that we have here. You know, we keep changing the course of rivers and so forth, and that's not good. At some point, rivers don't like it. They break away from these that human beings have set for them, and they go back to their natural courses. So let's hope, but let's wait and see.
Kiko, is there anything that you would like to add that you would like people here to know about?
Basically, you know, just the last tally is 25,000 people displaced, and the tally of the dead, they're expecting that it will go over 1,000 people once they finish the cleanup, which might happen within 2 months or so. And then, you know, there's the recovery. The estimates right now by officials is that the area will not be back to normal until perhaps 2014, 2015.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Kiko Brito from Greenpeace Brazil. For more on the Greenpeace climate campaign around the world, go to greenpeace.org. Thank you so much, Kiko.
You're welcome, Alex.
If we look at what's going on in the world today, we see so many different things happening at the same time, and it can be very confusing trying to make sense of the debates around these things. But when you actually look at these things holistically, it starts to make some sense. And unfortunately, what we have at the moment is a lot of people in different fields looking at everything in isolation. So you've got one lot of people looking at climate change, one lot of people looking at energy, another a bunch of guys looking at food, and some other guys looking at the economy, and then some other guys looking at terrorism and foreign policy. And what I think is really important to do is to look at these things as part of a global system. And when you do that, you actually come away with a different perspective.
Hey, Judy, I'll buy a couple of eggs this morning.
Okay, dear. Oh, but get a move on or you'll be late.
It's a great life, eh, Bob? When you stop to think about it, we take a lot for granted. And why shouldn't we?
My view is, having looked at a lot of these trends, is that some of the most worrying projections are most likely to be true. If you look at these things in their totality, what we're seeing is industrial civilization is now reaching a major tipping point. It's not saying that it's the end of the world, but it's saying that it's the end of a particular form of industrial civilization, which is based around unlimited growth and unconstrained interference with the natural environment. And that form of civilization has to change. And if it doesn't change, it will not survive. And either it's going to go down with a bang, or we could see a much more positive and sustainable change. But either way, all of these different crises are really just different manifestations of the fact that this civilization in its current form cannot survive the 21st century.
That's a trailer for a new movie based on the book A User's Guide to the Crisis of Civilization and How to Save It. The author, Nafees Mosaddegh Ahmed, coming up next on Radio EcoShock. After this little tribute to our Wall Street government by Ry Cooter.
Now if I see the police, for he sees me, I'm gonna run.